From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. President Biden acknowledged this week that he has not had the FDR-style first year in office that he had hoped for. This morning, he began his second year in office by joining the head of Intel, Pat Gelsinger, in announcing a new semiconductor facility in Ohio, which will work to help end those pandemic-related computer chip supply chain disruptions.
A brand new $20 billion campus outside of Columbus, Ohio. 7,000 construction jobs. 3,000 full-time jobs. And I was kidding Pat earlier. I said, I may need a job. And I said, well, it's not bad. You start over $100,000 on the line, but I got to get some training. But look.
Okay, Tanya, our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Francesca Chambers is White House correspondent for McClatchy. Hi, Francesca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And Jesse Holland is host of C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Jesse, happy Friday.
Same to you.
Okay, Francesca, Biden aides at the White House are now talking about a strategy shift for the year ahead. What kinds of shifts might we see?
Well, the White House now says that President Biden will rely more heavily on his legislative affairs team to make those negotiations with lawmakers on Build Back Better and other parts of his social spending and climate agenda. And part of the reason for that is to get President Biden himself out in communities more often, talking to the voters. That's a reflection of his polling, where he now has a roughly 42% approval rating. And the White House believes that if they can get the president back in front of those folks and doing what they say he does best, which is shaking hands and meeting voters, that they can draw a contrast between Republicans and Democratic policies.
Well, President Biden, in his news conference this week, he spoke to that point. He blamed some of his low poll numbers on how Americans are perceiving him. Let's listen.
The public doesn't want me to be the president's senator. They want me to be the president and let senators be senators.
So, Jesse, if we see more Biden kind of outside the Beltway, is it going to be easy to change his image at this point, or is it too late?
Well, President Biden is looking forward to the first real poll on his presidency, and that will be the midterm elections. So he has to get out and reverse the impression that Americans have of him. Republicans have been beating on him as being old. Republicans have been beating on him as being left-wing and not being able to get anything done and not being in charge of his own presidency. Biden needs to get out of the White House and become the chief executive of this country, not the 101st senator arguing back and forth with Mitch McConnell about what can be done and what can't be done. This is why I think you'll also see Biden start moving toward a lot more executive actions, doing his agenda through his own powers instead of trying to depend on Congress to do what he wants them to do.
Oh, Francesca, I want to bring you in here. This idea that he should take executive action. We often hear in Washington that a president has one big year to get things done because the second year is when we're dealing with the midterms. And then after that, the party and the White House almost always loses seats in Congress. With that, is Joe Biden's legislative agenda done? Is that a question to weigh in this moment?
Well, the president and Democrats say that they're going to try and break up his agenda and pass it in what he described as chunks. Now, they haven't laid out exactly how they would plan to do that. And you touch on an important point. How much truly could they get done, even with the support of Senators Manchin and Sinema, for that in an election year? They counted on the fact that they had bipartisan support in order to get infrastructure legislation done last year. But again, in an election year with so much on the line, how much Republican support could they get? Even President Biden suggested during his news conference that he didn't think that they would be able to get much, saying that he did not anticipate how much the Republican agenda would be just being against his agenda.
Well, Jesse, what about voting rights? This week, the Democrats' bill to counter restrictive state laws failed in Congress. That despite impassioned pleas from Democrats like Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock, who pushed back on Republicans' claims that voting is an issue states should control.
Please know that as the pastor of Dr. King's church, this argument evokes, I say really respectfully, it evokes some of the darkest moments in our country's long struggle for equality.
Jesse, do you think we'll see any more efforts on election rules changes at the national level?
we'll see the efforts, but the reality is 48 Democrats are not going to be able to get anything done in the Senate. They're facing the fact that they don't have the 50 votes and 51, of course, with the vice president. And they're facing the fact that in reality, the legislative calendar ends at summer recess. Because after the lawmakers come back after summer recess, they'll be continuing to look at midterm elections. So that we only have a shortened legislative calendar left, and Democrats only have 50 votes in the Senate, and they only have 48 they can count on. So the idea that Democrats are going to be able to push through anything that they can't get Republicans to agree to is probably little to none at this point.
Mm. Jesse, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell raised a bunch of eyebrows when he was asked about concerns about access to voting among voters of color. This is what he said.
Well, the concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans.
Of course, African-American voters are Americans. That clip has been viewed more than 4 million times on social media. Jesse, how did that comment land?
Well, I guarantee you, I believe that Senator McConnell wishes he could take those words back, or if he could add other words to make sure people knew that he included African-Americans as Americans. But it's one of those comments that for many minority voters confirm what they already think about the Republican Party, that the Republican Party is focused on white American voters and don't really care about anyone else. Now, there are plenty of Republicans who will disagree with that and say this was just a slip of the tongue, but it falls into that stereotype many minorities have about Republicans, in that Republicans don't care about minority voters. And when it comes from a top guy like Mitch McConnell, it's going to be heard over and over again from now until the next election day.
Francesca, let's talk about Joe Biden's likely rival in 2024, Donald Trump. How was his week as far as investigations in Washington and in the state of New York?
Well, for the former president, those investigations, as you mentioned, continue, and it continues to put January 6th and the part that his White House did or didn't play in January 6th and what happened at the Capitol in terms of whether or not they were quick enough to call on the violence to stop and the role that they played in the lead up to that rally. All of that continues to be at the forefront as Congress continues to investigate what happened that day. And then the Supreme Court also delivered a blow as it goes to the former president because he wanted to block White House records from the House committee that's investigating the January 6th attack, and he was unable to do so. So this could also set a precedent for future presidents as well when it comes to other issues in terms of how broad executive privilege actually is and what it can actually cover.
Francesca, I have to ask you about Rudy Giuliani. The news this week that the Trump lawyer was directly involved in putting together an alternate slate of electors to certify the 2020 election for Trump. At this point, is relitigating 2020 doing more to help or harm the Republicans, do you think?
Well, even Republicans would say that they do not think that the baseless election stolen claims are helpful to them. And when you look at states like Georgia, where that arguably, and they would say even in their view, cost them the election, they're not eager, many Republicans that is, to revisit some of those election claims. If you even look at the Virginia gubernatorial election that took place a few months ago, and Glenn Youngkin, he also distanced himself in ways from the former president, did not appear with him while campaigning. And so one of the things that we'll all be watching this year is how closely Republicans run with the former president, even those who have been endorsed by him, when you consider that he could come to their state and repeat some of those things. And everyone saw what happened in the Georgia runoff elections.
Jesse, I'm curious your thoughts on relitigating 2020. Will that do more to harm or help the Republicans from your view?
Well, the Republican Party will tell you that they don't want to do it, but Donald Trump certainly does. He has grabbed onto the 2020 election as an issue that he thinks will bring his voters, whether they're Republicans or not, they'll bring his voters out to either A, give him money, B, show up at a rally, or C, vote for the people he tells him to. So I think we'll hear more and more from it from Donald Trump, because that's the one thing that he thinks will bring his voters out. Now, will those voters end up voting for the rest of the Republican slate? We don't know. But he will keep pushing on that because he's someone has told him and he's thought that that's a winner for him. So he'll keep pushing on it. Whether it will help everyone else in the GOP, we'll have to wait and find out.
Jesse Holland is a host on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, and Francesca Chambers is White House correspondent for McClatchy. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Around this time, 25 years ago, a new artist planted the seed for what would become a new genre. His name was Maxwell, and he sounded nothing like the heavily sampled hip-hop-inspired R&B that dominated the airwaves. A voice that harkened back to the days of Motown, Maxwell's silky smooth falsetto was accompanied by orchestra-level instrumentation, bass, violins, and something that up until that moment had been left behind in the 80s, the horn solo. Maxwell joined contemporaries like D'Angelo, Lauryn Hill, and Erykah Badu in introducing the world to neo-soul. Rolling Stone compared his album Urban Hang Suite to Marvin Gaye's 1978 album Here, My Dear, writing that his exploration of monogamy and matrimony was like a response to Gaye's exploration of divorce. The album is also known for restoring something else lost somewhere between the 80s and the 90s, deeply soulful music about Black people loving each other.
I remember having a journal. I always have a journal. And I said, you know, God, if you give me this opportunity, I promise to stay true to the creative, you know, thing that made me love Marvin Gaye, made me love Al Green.
Maxwell and I caught up with each other in May of last year, off the heels of his 25th anniversary performance for the NAACP Image Awards. And we got right into talking about the songs on the album that cemented his place as a neo-soul pioneer.
How are you, Tanya? How you doing?
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm good. I mean, I'm amazed. I'm elated. I'm surprised. I'm shocked. I can't believe this album. It wasn't like it was this thing that you heard on radio. We were all just beginning, and radio was really starting to understand that maybe this is a movement that they should get behind.
Nominated for a Grammy for Best Album, Urban Hang Suite starts and ends with two versions of the same instrumental. The first release was Till the Cops Come Knockin'. Gonna take you in the room, sugar. Lock you up in love for days. We're gonna be walking, baby. Till the cops come knockin'. A song about police knocking on the door of a couple so enraptured they stay holed up in their apartment for days. Blender magazine named it one of the greatest makeout songs of all time. Maxwell, folks can't see you, but I'm watching you. Every time we play your music, you like put your hands over your face. Are you still nervous when you hear yourself?
Yeah, you know, because it's almost like an alter ego, you know? And then when I think about the fact that I wrote that song when I was 20 years old, I mean, like, what did I know about that stuff? But I mean, you know, of course, time has taught me many things, but I'll just keep going from that part.
But wait, you wanted this to be your first single, and you made a big point to say, this is the one. Why did you want this song to be your debut?
I mean, I think, I just feel like the relationship that we have with the police is always, being Black is the problem. And the fact that a song could talk about Black love being the reason why, you know, there's a disturbance that we need to kind of look into. What I see on TV, or what I saw on TV with people who look like me, we were either drug dealers, we were either unable to, you know, have successful relationships. it was so important to be able to sort of express that aspect of who we are as people, the part of being Black that is Black love.
The second release, Ascension, marked a breakthrough for Maxwell into the Billboard Top 40 charts. But even with his success, Maxwell says he felt like an outsider, constantly trying to make sense of who he was in a world that largely sees things in black and white.
It's very interesting, you know, times have changed dramatically, but when you're, you know, a Brooklyn kid coming from a Caribbean background, having a Haitian mother, having a Puerto Rican father, you know, I would hear it all the time. People in the neighborhood, like, oh, you know, y'all, you're the island guy.
That's where the mystique comes in. A star so reluctant, he chose not to have his face on the front cover of his first album.
I remember I would hear from people, like, I want to see how they're going to market this. The interesting thing about it is that I learned through the process of Urban Hang Suite and subsequent albums after, that the thick skin that I didn't think I had, it was there. It was more so there because the music was dictating the destiny that I was, I guess, supposed to get to eventually. And I think if you ask a lot of artists, like, you know, who have done music throughout their lives or whatever, I feel like the best records make themselves in some ways because of how much I love the tradition of soul music and what it means to the Black experience, to the civil rights movement. You know, songs like, you know, R.E.S.P.E.C.T. by Aretha Franklin, God rest her soul. I mean, these were songs that allowed people to get up and go out there and march. A Change Is Gonna Come, Sam Cooke. It's a tradition that has, like, given us an ability to sort of come together as people and even therapeutically get through the hard, harsh days of what it is to be Black in America.
Mm. Well, you're known for taking your time between albums, taking your time, I would guess, to reflect and be still. At least that's what I think. And in some ways, the whole world right now during this pandemic can relate to that need to be still. What do you think can be gained from pressing pause and getting quiet?
I personally like to have a life. So for me, making music is a slice of the pie, and all the things that you know, inspire the music, at least hopefully, those things are part of life lived that then I can apply to the songs.
Well, with that, it's been 6 years since your last album came out, Black Summer's Night. I know five. You hate it. Five, not six. I better get that right.
No, you know what? I'm always like, you know what I love about when people think it's a longer time? It means more to me that you think it's longer than it was because...
No, I just can't count, obviously, Maxwell.
No, I just think that it's some, you know... I'll put it like this, right? If you care about something and you care about someone, if they're gone one day, that one day feels like a week. So if it feels longer between records, I take it in as like, wow, they really like the last album so much that it feels like an eternity or something. I don't know. Or maybe it is an eternity. I don't know.
But with that, it's been 5 years since your last album came out. I know you probably hate this question, but what is next?
We're working. I mean, I have a chalkboard filled with at least, I don't know, I think maybe 50 songs or something. So we're just picking the right ones, putting them together, designing them, sequencing them.
What are the small moments you look forward to experiencing again and performing in front of live crowds again?
I can tell you this. The awards are amazing. You know, I'm cool with, you know, being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't mind that.
Yeah, you're not going to say no to that, but yes.
You know, I'm not mad at the Grammys. I'm not mad at the, you know, the whatever awards that are out there. But I am so grateful to the real lives that have been touched. I hear stories about people playing this woman's work when they're having their child, people playing Lifetime when they've lost a loved one. I'm literally near tears as I'm expressing this to you. These are the true awards. This is what really it is. This is the stuff that I will be able to take to heaven with me. This is what I look forward to when the world opens up and we can burn up and we can go out and get on the beach and go to shows and do those things. And I'm a little rusty right now, and I'm gonna be, you know, I'm gonna rehearse like probably for like a year, because I just really want to be on point, because I know that anybody who goes to a show is going to expect nothing less than absolute best from not only me, but from anybody who steps on that stage. So to all the people who survived the pandemic, to all the people who lost people during the pandemic, to all the people who lost people because of the civil unrest that we're experiencing around the world, you know, my heart goes out to you. I hope that when we get to a place where we can all connect again, that we can give you the show that can get us to the next part of this new decade.
Well, Maxwell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Grammy Award-winning musician Maxwell talking about the 25th anniversary of Urban Hang Suite. And hey, Maxwell and I talked music for almost an hour about the changing industry, the comparisons to another neo-soul great, D'Angelo, and how the late DMX made him feel seen. You can hear all of that on a special podcast of our conversation on the Here and Now feed, wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you been in the grocery store lately? Yeah, it looks like a hurricane is about to hit. Empty shelves, long lines, and sticker shock. Well, Ali Velshi, anchor and economics correspondent for MSNBC, joins us now to talk about why. Hey, Ali.
Hey, Scott. All news is local, by the way. I'm trying to get an order of my Maker's oats, and they've run out, and I asked why, and they said supply chain issues.
That's what we're going to ask about. What is going on here? Is it not enough workers to manufacture and process food, or not enough truckers to deliver it to the store? What?
Well, look, I'm the typical person, right? When I wonder where groceries come from, I think the grocery store, but I don't think about all of the supply chain behind it, because we've largely perfected it over the last several decades. But it's basically all of the above. It is workers in stores. It is truckers to get the material to the depots and the grocery stores. It's farms who are experiencing higher costs, including input costs like fertilizer. It's meatpacking plants. It's stuff that we ship from other places. In some cases, it's the packaging into which the food goes. I've spoken to some producers who say, we've got all the food we need. We don't have the boxes. We don't have the little things they go into. So this is the fixable part of it. Generally speaking, you can fix supply chain issues like this over time, but basically all of it is contributing to the fact that either you're running out of stuff or things that are available at a higher price than you're used to paying.
Well, researching this, I came across a study suggesting that one of the most vulnerable food sectors is animal slaughtering and processing, so the meat aisle, because it relies a lot on human beings to get the product out the door. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, and you know, the meatpacking industry itself is dominated by a few global companies that are trying to deal with the fact that they ship their products all over the place. Most people don't buy sort of local and organic meat. This is one of the biggest mega industries out there. There is a shortage of slaughterhouse capacity. There's a shortage of workers. And again, it's the same thing, shortage of trucks to transport it. And the other part of it is that wages are up in America and people are at home and there's not a shortage of demand. People want their meat. There's an unusually strong consumer demand for meat, particularly beef right now. People hunkering down at home in winter and they're trying to buy the stuff and the costs are going up. And it's just hard to get this adjusted to the right level. It will happen, but it doesn't happen quickly.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. On the supply side, I mean, will this get better when COVID gets better? Because a lot of people who quit their jobs in the pandemic, they might never come back.
Yeah, that's right. But because we still are unsure about that, we still have issues with kids and whether they can go to school in person or not, or kids getting sent home. There are a lot of caregivers of kids who are typically women, for instance, who have said, until this is all sorted out and I know that I can go to a job and I don't have to come back to get my kid or take care of them or teach them at home, I'm staying out of the workforce. So there's definitely a deliberate shortage of workers right now. Some of that will get fixed. But again, this is a perfect storm, right? It's truck drivers, it's store workers, it's plant workers, it's slaughterhouse workers. It is actual raw materials. It's even shipping of certain ingredients that are needed that you can't get locally. So we're in the perfect storm. Grocery store CEOs have said at least another 6 weeks or so of this, until things sort themselves out. And that's assuming that Omicron starts to, burn itself out and we don't get yet another wave of a new one. But it'll be a while before we've sorted out these things. And in the meantime, we're either going to have to replace what we normally buy or pay more for what we want.
Yeah. Okay. 6 weeks. All right. March, we'll have dinner together.
That's
Ali
right.
Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
When Orini Kaipara was a young girl growing up in New Zealand, she'd often race to the television to watch the nation's first Maori news presenters.
Well, when I was young, when I was a little girl, I remember watching TV. I'm smiling when I say this. I remember always anticipating watching the news, and it was the Māori news, Te Karere, because of a woman named Tini Molyneux, and she was the idol for many of us young Māori children. I remember watching her at home and at school because she looked like me.
Decades later, Kaipara is now taking the next step in representing the Indigenous people of New Zealand. Last month, she became the first woman to anchor a primetime news broadcast with a traditional Maori face marking. Orini Kaipara joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
When the announcement was made over the holidays, you said you felt overwhelmed by the response. I can only imagine. How are you feeling now?
It's settled down, so I'm kind of, it's been a crazy whirlwind of a month, I would say, since appearing on the 6 p.m. news bulletin or news show here in New Zealand for three, for News Hub. Yeah, it's been overwhelming in the sense that I didn't really expect so much attention, but it's been a lovely surprise and just exciting. It's kept me very busy over the summer break, I must admit.
Right. A lot of folks want to talk with you about it. Both Maori women and men have traditional face markings. Can you tell us more about them?
Each tribe here in New Zealand, Maori tribe, will have a different sort of take on what mata ora or moko kauai is. So moko, tamoko, and especially on the face, is a birthright. What it symbolizes, a deep spiritual connection to your ancestors. So for me, my moko is a physical embodiment of who I am as a woman, but who I directly descend from through my ancestry, through my heritage.
You took this journey to tap into that deep spiritual connection with your moko kauai back in 2019. Can you take us through the process of how you got there, to that moment of deciding to stand proud in your culture in this way?
I received my moko in 2019, at the start of 2019, but it actually was something I had contemplated the year prior to getting it. So, my life was quite, I felt, was hitting rock bottom, and just internalizing my role and my purpose and refinding myself. That part of that process was actually digging deep into who I am as, the daughter of my grandmother or as the daughter of my mother, and just researching that story. And it just stuck with me, really, the want and the need to get a moko kauai. Now, I'm the first in my generation to receive this. And so that was part of the internalizations, as well as the fact that, how I would be received or perceived by my own family, first and foremost, but by people who have known me all my life and by the wider public. Those sort of internalizations are quite hard because we're coming into a period of, trying to reclaim who we are as Indigenous people to Aotearoa. And it's not an easy journey because a lot of that knowledge was wiped out through, through laws and through government forcing a lot of things and taking away a lot of things from Māori people here in New Zealand. And so it's a long journey for every single one of us.
Orini, I want to slow down a beat here because what you're saying here is really powerful. I want to go back to what you're saying about your family and your family's reactions. You being the first person in several generations to get a mokokawe, just tell us what was their reaction?
Come the day when I did get it, it was powerful. It was an intimate ceremony. It was a 3.5 hour process. By the time it finished and I sat up on the table, there were lots of tears. I had a lot of tears throughout the whole 3.5 hour journey. I saw pride in my mother's eyes. I saw fear in my mother's eyes. I saw fear in a lot of eyes in that room. And it wasn't at the kauai itself. It was more what it represents. And I also saw pride and maybe a little bit of relief that it's back now. You know, it's the strength mm-hmm. and the dignity, you know, that you have, that I had that morning that reflected every single person in the room and all the ancestors that, you know, that we're connected to.
How did you get over the fear of it harming your career?
It crossed my mind, the fact that to get a moko kauai may hinder or may jeopardise my role as a newsreader or as a journalist here in New Zealand. But it also crossed my mind at the same time that this is the only country in the world that should actually acknowledge and, you know, will be the place, the one and only place in the world that would accept it because this is the land where it belongs. You know, those were internalisations. I was like, well, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not doing this for my job. I really pushed that thought way, you know, to the back of my head and thought, no, why am I doing this? I'm doing this for me. I'm doing this for my family, for my children, for myself.
Reminding yourself of who you are and that you're more than just a newsreader. And language is also something you've taken on, now using the Maori language on air for common phrases like coming up and stay with us. I mean, you're restoring through your presence a culture erased. Is that how you see it?
That's quite a profound statement, but yeah, it's only really just dawned on me in the last couple of years. Well, since having this moko kauai, and that's what, you know, the beauty I feel, you know, only less than 20% of our country, of our total population, understand, let alone can speak Te Reo Māori. So I'm very much aware of that, and it's about trying to strike the right balance in terms of, you know, showing appreciation for the reo, for the language, but also trying to encourage people to be okay with just hearing it. Because right now, I can tell you what, Tania, there's still a lot of resistance to the Māori language here in New Zealand.
Orini Kaipara, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tania.
Scientists have been estimating the force of the volcanic eruption in Tonga over the weekend. Some experts think it could have released more energy than the biggest nuclear bomb ever tested. That was the Soviet Union's Tsar Bomba in 1961. As NPR's Jeff Broomfield reports, researchers are starting to piece together how the eruption happened.
In 2015, an entirely new island rose from the Pacific Ocean. It was created by a powerful underwater volcano to the north of Tonga's main island. Jim Garvin is chief scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He says the process of growing the island created something else.
It produces layers, we call them reservoirs, of liquid rock under a solid rock crust.
That liquid rock or magma flowed through tubes and channels and vast underground caverns. In December of last year, a huge amount spewed towards the surface. The island expanded, but beneath the waves, Garvin believes something else was happening.
The plumbing system underwater changed.
And then, this past weekend, he thinks it changed again. Liquid seawater flowed suddenly and forcefully into the chambers filled with liquid magma.
When you put a ton of seawater into a cubic kilometer of liquid rock, things are going to get bad fast.
A huge explosion. That's what one Twitter user recorded from an island in Fiji, over 250 miles away. And the sound went a lot farther than that.
People in Alaska heard it. So it was a humongous explosion. No doubt about that whatsoever.
Michael Poland is a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He says this may have been one of the loudest events on planet Earth in over a century, but the eruption itself wasn't all that big.
The amount of magma that came out was relatively small. especially when you compare it to the size of the explosion that it created.
To be clear, the explosion blew to bits the island that the volcano had made just a few years before. The tsunami and ash cloud that followed have done a huge amount of damage to Tonga, which is now in the midst of a massive humanitarian emergency. But really big volcanic eruptions can change the climate of the entire Earth. Poland doesn't expect that to happen in this case. Nevertheless, he does think there will be a lot of interest in the blast. He says it could teach scientists more about what happens when Earth and sea collide. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
The education system is at an inflection point as we enter year three of this pandemic. Most schools are pushing to stay open during a surge in COVID-19 cases fueled by the Omicron variant, but many are having a tough time with staffing and ensuring students, parents, and staff are satisfied with safety measures. Elsewhere on the program, we hear from high school students organizing walkouts to demand better conditions. Right now, let's hear from the teacher's perspective. Osa Tui Jr. is president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association and joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Your union represents more than 13,000 public school teachers, and there's only one statewide school district there run by the Hawaii State Department of Education. What are you hearing from teachers about current conditions due to COVID?
Our teachers are struggling. First burnt out from a whole, you know, going into the third year of COVID, it's been a struggle. And to now come into the Omicron variant where classrooms might have a third, a half of the class not in the classroom, they don't know whether to start a new lesson or not. To have such staffing shortages where security guards and others are being pulled in to essentially babysit classes because there's no lessons going on, and classes having to be put into gymnasiums, auditoriums, cafeterias, just so that there's adult supervision. It is very crazy right now.
How is this situation impacting you personally?
Well, you know, everyone needs some mental health, and we just haven't had any mental health breaks. Everyone is trying to do their best to keep the students safe, which is the ultimate goal here. I have parents and grandparents who are just so upset that their children are bringing home COVID. And in Hawaii, where the cost of living is so high, we have so many multi-generational homes. So to have the young ones bringing home COVID, where we have very elderly people, grandmothers, grandfathers, just to hear the students say, oh, you know, I've got COVID, my mom had COVID, my uncle has COVID, everybody, you know, in these families are now catching COVID, and they can't even come to school to pick up work sometimes. And teachers are just doing everything they can to keep students where they need to be and trying to make sure that they can juggle the different lessons, the different places that all of their students are.
A former teacher in North Texas has a TikTok video that has become very popular that's been widely viewed, and it really doubles down on what you're saying. She's concerned about superintendent turnover and says that at this rate, there aren't going to be any teachers around next year. Her name is Felicia Jimenez, and here she is on TikTok.
Teachers are out with COVID. They're just putting them in these spreader events like combining classes. Kids are in classes without teachers, and masks are still optional in several of these districts. Almost all of them, masks are still optional. I need you to understand that next year, teachers are not taking this abuse, and we will have no teachers for our kids.
She brings up a good point about the future, how sustainable this is. What are your concerns about the future of the education system at large, not just Hawaii, but across the country, if conditions don't change?
Yes, we're seeing people leaving the profession in droves, especially those who can retire as soon as possible. They're not waiting anymore. Throughout the country, teachers don't feel valued. It's a lot of just words like, we value you, but then the actions don't match with the words. And that's really what's upsetting and what is driving people out of the profession and not attracting folks into the profession.
Your union is advocating for improved access to testing, high-quality masks for all, and more transparency around metrics that basically determine when a school needs to transition to hybrid learning. What has been the response from the district?
Yes, we've been asking since Delta was going on, and as Delta was coming down, we were saying we need to plan. There needs to be a plan for when the next variant comes along, because there's going to be a next variant. And sure enough, Omicron came and showed us that, yes, if you didn't plan, you were going to be stuck. And Well, unfortunately, our district has kind of made the determination that, no, they're not going to plan for that. And now we're seeing the consequences.
Well, you know, the response from the district, though, is to look at the numbers. They report between December 1st and the 20th of December, a daily average of just 19 positive cases across nearly 42,000 staff and 160,000 students. It says that these numbers actually show that mitigation strategies are working and that schools can and should stay open. What do you say to that?
They're saying that as Omicron hadn't really fully hit yet. Now we're looking at just in the past week or so, a daily average of 564 cases in our schools versus 19. So to say that, you know, our strategies work, look how low it were. Now we see, no, those strategies actually didn't work and we have high case counts in our schools.
Osa Tui Jr. is president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association. The union represents more than 13,000 public school teachers. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
And we asked the Hawaii Department of Education for comment, and a spokesperson referred us to the most recent newsletter from Interim Superintendent Keith Hayashi. He acknowledges the demands placed on schools right now are intense and that the department is actively exploring strategies to provide relief. Hayashi says working with state and federal agencies is what they're doing right now to ensure that the district has enough COVID-19 tests for staff and students. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.